Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Whoa, man. Yeah.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter, and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky and Arkansas, as a public service presentation. We'd all like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine, a finer recovery journal that affords some print space from time to time. I gratefully like to acknowledge my co-host, Harold B., a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe that the families are the basic unit of our society, and as the family goes, so does the country. Harold just called, and Harold's on a deadline and not going to be able to join us this evening. And I was hoping to reach Michael M., the fellow who did this segment that we're going to do this evening, and he's out of pocket also. So tonight I'm the lone stranger. We'll muddle through it together. If anybody'd like to call, the call-in phone number is 949-534-0621. Again, 949-534-0621. I'd like to start this evening, started a new tradition, reciting the third step prayer. Third step prayer in the venue of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have certain prayers of understanding as we go through the 12 steps, and the steps are the repentance process for children. Highly spiritual, highly non-religious. This is a kindergarten for the spiritually stunted, and this is some of the things that gets us going again. I give this to my sponsees early on when I first take them on as a sponsee. I ask them to call, one of the assignments I give them is to call someone every day, one different every day for 30 days, and ask their permission to recite the third step prayer to them. The reason I have them do that, and I always explain why I have than do anything in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because we're adults, and I think it's important to know the reasoning, the rationale. First of all, it gets them picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, they're calling the fellow members, men, in their home group. So people are getting to know their name, and he's getting to know their name, and he's connecting up in his fellowship. Three, the third step prayer encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And fourth, the man he might be calling might be thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol. And chances are, once he tells them this prayer, the likelihood has diminished drastically. That's one of the into action. Third step prayer goes like this. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. There's no amen, but it sounds like it's supposed to be there. So this evening, we're going to be discussing It's on the website. It's under 12 and 24, times 5,000. That means 12 steps in 24 hours. Dr. Bob had sponsored 5,000 men. It seems to be going around. There's a general feeling that I'm getting, and from different information, it's a back to basics concept of sponsorship. It's just happening, and Rum Radio is part of that. People see that. Some don't agree with it, so they do their own, but we're all pushing together in the same area to enliven sponsorship. Our basic text, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, states, our sobriety is contingent upon the maintenance of a daily spiritual condition. I ask people, what maintains itself of itself? Nothing maintains itself by itself. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually. And if you're declining spiritually, your sobriety, if not your recovery, if not your sobriety, becomes tentative. The one immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. That's the basis of the AA program, is working with the newcomer. You can't keep it unless you give it away. Some people would say that we languish, we put a lot more emphasis on the going to the rooms, keep coming back. I did for years and didn't work the steps, and I realized when life on life's terms and the pain got to be unbearable again is when I finally finished. I don't recommend that for many people. I think we've lost some ground because we don't get sponsorship in the forefront as it was in the beginning of the AA movement. And I think we've paid and paid dearly for missing out on what the pioneers had already discovered. Intensive work with another alcoholic. Quickly. Not coming back over and over again, waiting to find someone that you relate to, being complacent, relaxing in the meetings, but getting into the hard work of 12-step recovery. They're simple, but they're not easy. The fellow who sent me this is Michael M. out of the Chicagoland area. And the first thing I asked him to do is to do a little bio. Who is Michael? Before we get into the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous using the Big Book, our basic text, in 24 hours, one day. Now, of course, I've never done that. The information's here for those who want to use it. This might be really good for people in prisons. There's a movement going around right now to get them through even in a shorter period of time. Originally, it was a very short-lived proposition to work the steps. Initially, there was only 6 steps. Dr. Bob, one of our co-founders, had worked the 6 steps, went to his town. He was a doctor in his town and made his amends, went around to the people that he had harmed. And from his last drunk to his first trip with Bill W. to Towns Hospital, he was 3 days sober. He started with a new man, Bill Duff, who's the AA's number 3. So I have this section titled, I'm No Angel Named Michael. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Michael. What I'm recovered from is a hopeless state of mind and body, which was systematically killing me to the most nefarious brand of torture imaginable. The Big Book terms it pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I lived in hell for the first 25 years of my life. I would tell people in meetings, I lived in hell, but I was comfortable there because I knew where all the light switches were. First, there was the covert hell of living each and every day, sure that I was broken in a way that no human being had ever been broken before. And then came the hell of spiraling in a sea of booze and chemicals, slowly dragging toward an alcoholic death. My restlessness, irritability, and discontent was a perpetual state from which I deeply believed there was no escape. Turns out I suffered from a very common illness to which there was a remarkably simple solution. You know, sometimes in the rooms we state that we come to the conclusion that alcoholism and drug addiction is a disease. Now, people outside of that have a hard time with that. They believe that it's a matter of willpower or won't power. What's wrong with you? Aren't you man enough just not to stop like the rest of us? And they don't really seem to get the idea that once you've gone down to a certain line, once you've crossed a certain line, that coming back takes more than an act of will. It actually takes the intervention of God and a lot of work. That's my experience. I will continue. I will spare you extensive drunkalogue. I will avoid such a thing for two simple reasons. First, my story bores the hell out of me. It didn't always resonate that way, mind you. When I first entered the rooms of recovery, I understood my story to be unbelievably fascinating. I might not be much, but I'm all I think about. I longed for an opportunity to recount all the gory details to everyone who would listen. Shakespeare said there was nothing so common as the wish to be remarkable. In retrospect, I have a hard time locating what in the hell I thought was so interesting. It was the same people and the same stories and the same women and the same bars and the same day after day after day. You know what's interesting? Recovery. Recovery is interesting. Since I put down my medicine on September 20th, 1997, not one day of this journey has looked anything like any other day. Some of them have been absurd, abundantly glorious. Some of them had been abysmally painful. But every single one of them has been a unique cog in the ongoing odyssey of Michael being the main player in his own existence. The other reason I will choose not to belabor with you with machinations of my alcoholic life is because I trust that you could not possibly need any more data on how to successfully destroy a life. I don't know about you, but I don't spend time in Alcoholics Anonymous to hear stories about people undoing themselves. I know how to do that. I'm an expert in this area. I go to AA to find out more about waking up every morning with hope, about living comfortably inside my own skin and walking outside amongst the humans actually feeling like one of them, no better or worse than anyone, a person among people, a worker among workers, in terms of a speaker, making clear to me that the quality for the seat, there are really only two drinks that I need to hear about. The first one and the last one. In light of this, I will take this opportunity to present my qualification to be a member of this glorious organization. My experience is that oftentimes, especially in speaker meetings, we have things in AA called circuit speakers, and they go around to conventions and to large groups, and anytime there's a gathering, anniversaries, and etc. And they'll tell their story. And some come far and wide. I know some of them that travel the world. Funny guys. were funny in a sense. Well, I'm not a circuit speaker. They're very funny in the sense that the things that make us laugh, being in that desperation, most people would not laugh at. If you're not been addicted and recovered, you might not find some of these speakers funny at all, but some of them are hilarious. Oftentimes, they speak to the problem. So newcomers go there and they hear their story, which really quite an eye-opener, an enlightening course of events when you hear your story coming out of someone else's mouth. Sadly, in my experience, too much of the problem and not enough of the solution. I'll be waiting sometimes and go, okay, well, it's 40 minutes and we're still in step one. He's going to come to the solution any time now. And finally, we get bits and pieces. Some do really good. Some go, I think, 15 minutes, 20 minutes of the problem. We're asked in the big book to share what was it like, what happened, and what it's like now, in a general way. That's the template. Everything else is up for grabs. I tell my sponsees, now we'll take a look at the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's 12 of them. 12 is an interesting number. I looked up in Google, 12 is the number of the ultimate authority. 12 months, 12 apostles, 12 steps. One step, step one, is the only step that mentions the addictive substance or the problem. Alcohol, food, sex, workaholic. There's even Debtors Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous. There's even a Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody tell you where they hold the meetings. But the number one step is the only one that talks the problem. The other 11 steps address the solution. We call it a design for living. And I tell my sponsees when they can start sharing after they've worked step five and not until, because now they can speak to the solution and they're also available to be a temporary sponsor after we've worked step five. I try to get them in the trenches as quickly as I can. It's their call. I make suggestions. But I think that's the one way to ensure the work that we've just done, to reinforce it. And I ask them, now look at that. When you share, I want you to remember, 1/12 of the steps is the problem and 11/12 are the solution. We live in the solution, not in the problems. Back to Michael. I was 14 years old and closing in on the end of my freshman year of high school. A girl named Kim, whose parents had left town for the weekend, was hosting what promised to be the bash of the year. A senior named Patrick gave me a ride to the big jam and I vividly recall hopping out of his car and walking down the long, grassy slope leading to Kim's spacious home. As I approached the door, a kid named Mary came walking toward me with a welcoming smile and two cold beers. I had tried alcohol before this point, but nothing more than a sip or two here and there. Marty was one of the cooler kids in my class, and while we were quite friendly, the want to impress him was always great. With the awareness that chugging a beer was considered quite cool by most, I realized that I had a great desire to do just that with the can he had handed me. On the other hand, I was holding some fear that my efforts to do so would be unsuccessful, resulting in spitting it back or having it dribble out through my nose. Having made a risk versus reward assessment, I decided to take a run at it, and while quite difficult, I successfully chugged the beer. I remember that I liked that I had done it. Even more than that, I remember liking that he liked it. But what I remember most of all was that from the time it took me to finish the beer to the time I crossed the threshold into Kim's house, I became aware of the 14 years of fear had evaporated as a result of one aluminum can of liquid. I proceeded to ask myself what I still understand to be an entirely brilliant question. Where's more of this, and how do I never run out of it? My experiences as an alcoholic is that, and other alcoholics will say this oftentimes, everybody remembers the first time they take in enough alcohol to trigger. Fear goes away. We can dance. We can sing. We can approach pretty girls fearlessly. Whoa, pretty good. Most guys have a fear of, well, in this generation, that generation that I'm in, I'm older than Michael, but I'm in that generation. Our fear was more of rejection from women. It's interesting. Today, the fear is intimacy with women. But back then, it was fear of rejection. And alcohol took away that fear. People in the meeting would say, you know, I didn't know how I could dance unless I was drinking. We could dance. We could sing. We could talk. We were the life of the party. All fears melted away from us. We were bulletproof. We were funny. We were glib. We were witty. People liked us. Or so we thought. But that was the illusion. And alcohol is a cunning foe. I heard someone say in a meeting one time, alcohol gave me wings and then took the sky away. Back to Michael. I drank all night and passed out behind a couch. When I came to the next morning, it was clear that more than half the party had done the same. With bodies strewn hither and nigh to wrap Kim's living room. As I sat up, I found myself replete with the many morning after symptoms, which were soon to become all too familiar elements of my life. My mouth was a desert. Well, I remember that. I remember the the French Foreign Legion had walked barefoot through my mouth. My stomach was in knots. My head was pounding. My joints ached. My goodness, guy sounds like he's 60 or 70 years old. My joints ached. Actually, none of these concerned me too greatly. What did concern me, though, was the fact that I had managed to shit my pants in the night. With this fact firm in mind, I realized I needed a plan, and fast. I jumped up, found the guest room, stripped off my pants, pulled off the blue underpants, making sure that they were not one of the pairs from sleepaway camp, which had tags with my name sewed into the waistband, threw the soiled underpants underneath the sink with the Brillo and the toilet brush, and hit the pavement. When I returned to school on Monday, my nasty little stash, clearly having been discovered, everyone was talking about the repugnant incident, including me. Somebody did what? I was asking my buddies. Nobody knew it was me. Within a day or two, the storm passed, and that was that. Consequences of drinking, over drinking. I have a friend of mine now. He's an older gentleman. He drinks, and the only reason he drinks is to get drunk. That's it. That's the only reason he drinks. If you're a true alcoholic, a real alcoholic, that's why you drink. A normal person, a normal drinker, or even a heavy drinker sometimes, will not drink just to get drunk. Although that's a consequence. As most people who don't have a couple beers, they'll turn around or a couple drinks and they'll say, that's enough for me, I'm starting to feel it. The alcoholic questions that thought. Well, you're starting to feel it, that's why I'm drinking, so I can feel it. Essentially, the alcoholic loves the feeling, the sensation they get from the first drink of alcohol. Starts a thing called a craving. Now, of course, Michael, and he's a young man right now, and he's not, you know, he wouldn't say he was an alcoholic, even though he drank alcoholically, but one drunk to make an alcoholic, not at 14 or 15 years old, no way. But what happens is some have a propensity. Now, we found it might be genetically predisposed. If your father was an alcoholic and your grandfather was an alcoholic and your uncle's an alcoholic, chances are you've inherited a recessive gene. Now, in the Genome Project, I don't believe they've discovered that yet. I believe that they will eventually. I believe the American Indian, for one, has that recessive gene. I believe a lot of the Irish, because of all the generations of drinking alcohol, have developed that recessive gene. If we're not, aren't we not who we come from? Is the DNA not part and partial of our ancestry? If I'm out on a date and I don't drink, and this was early on, and my date said, oh, you're not drinking. And I would speak up and say, well, no, I'm allergic. Oh, some would let it go with that. And some would say, oh, really? How does that, what happened? I said, I break out in handcuffs. So sometimes that's good enough to get going. The years of sobriety has taught me I'm not worried what people think of me. Some people don't know me, and they don't like me. Some people get to know me, then they don't like me. It's none of my business what you think of me, because you think so little of me anyway. If not in stature, surely in time. The only time somebody's really thinking of me is that if I give them a resentment. And I was taught early on, it's better to give a resentment than to get a resentment. If somebody's upset with me, he's giving me free room in his head or her head. And if you give free room, you give vent, you give room to an alcoholic in your head, in the shortest amount of time, they will build a garage and a guest room, make a bed, and have dinner there. So the best thing you can do with things like that, we have to live in acceptance and just let it go. People are going to be people. The message I took from, back to Michael, the message I took from this experience was the following. I drank alcohol. It was awesome. I ran into a little jam, did what I needed to do to deal with it. Good. And every single story I could possibly tell you about my reluctant resultant drinking and drugging career is that story. Everyone. Some of these stories include drugs. Some don't. Some of them include women and sex. Some of them include cops. Some of them are funny. Some of them are tragic. But every single one is simply the story of Michael having a complete inability to live inside of himself and searching desperately for an anesthetic that would successfully shut down the feelings. Very well written, quite the understanding. You could say this was a template for most folks in AA. That's not all. And where this led me a little over a decade later was a life lived almost entirely within my living room, smoking crack and snorting heroin round the clock, naked, as though I was sweating too much to wear clothes, watching reruns of SportsCenter, which I had already seen 3 times that evening, and wondering how I had gotten there. And this confluence of exterior mess brought to me what we like to refer to as a bottom. The best definition for a bottom that I have ever heard is, the bottom is the point at which the circumstances of your life begin to drop quicker than your ability to justify them. Very good. I'm going to read that again. The best definition for bottom that I have ever heard is, the bottom is the point at which the circumstances of your life begin to drop quicker than your ability to justify them. This is the process that occurred for me, and all of a sudden, and without warning, my medicine stopped silencing the screams in my head and began to amplify them. My father had been in AA for about a decade at that time, and not quite ready to put a bullet in my head, I came to you guys. It's a progressive disease, folks. It just is. We like to think that we can handle it, we can control it. We make repeated attempts. Michael doesn't mention that, but I'm sure that came in from time to time. We swore off. We made oaths to God, to our spouses, to our girlfriends, to our dog, to our mother, to our father, to our friends. We were never going to do this again. We were going to hide one time, and that was it. We were going to really blast it up sometimes and never have to do it again, and we were never going to drink or drug again, and on and on. Then we would try, well, maybe if I only drank rum, maybe if I only did coke and cocaine, and then I only drank beer, or maybe I just forget the beer, just do so much coke. Maybe if I got rid of the heroin and just drank rum, and all these machinations of trying to come up with the perfect balance, sometimes of uppers and downers and alcohol, and we'd have this perfect balance where we'd have the buzz, but we would be able to function like a regular person, and no one would know. And that was something I liked, and I know some people in the program, some the same, that we were fooling you, that you didn't know that we were high, smoke marijuana, and go to a party, and you know, and just be there, you know, witty and funny, or drinking, and, you know, so balance that out, maybe a little methamphetamine, and, you know, balance that out, and nobody knew that I was high, and I was putting it over on everybody. Basically, I wasn't putting it over on anybody other than myself. Back to Michael. The first things an alcoholic ever said to me in AA meeting was just after the conclusion of my very first one. I had zipped over to the coffee urn to grab a cup of Java for the road when a guy came up behind me and said, "What do you think?" Michael, having turned with a confused look, "Are you talking to me?" The stranger, "Yep." "What do you think?" Michael, "Meeting?" The stranger, "Right." "No, Michael, he was asking you what you thought about the stock market." "Of course the meeting." "Michael, I didn't like it." Stranger. "Oh, how long did it take you to figure out what you didn't like it, that you didn't like it?" Michael, "About 5 minutes. Pretty cocky." Stranger, "But you stayed the whole hour. Why?" Michael, hesitating. Well, just forget it. You wouldn't understand. Stranger, try me. Michael, well, even though I don't really like you people, you seem to have something that I have been looking for my whole life. And I don't even know what it is. Ah, something there. Stranger, do you want to know what it is? Michael, okay. Stranger, we're awake. Michael, awake? I'm awake? Stranger, no, you're not. You're asleep. Michael, what the hell, man? I'm clearly not asleep. Stranger, really, let me ask you a question. Are you the central factor in your own life? Are you driving your circumstances and participating, or you're standing still where your life just happens to you? Michael, stunned. The second one. The latter. Stranger, that's why you're asleep. Michael, okay, so how do I wake up? Stranger, God. My response, God? I believe in God. The stranger, you believe in God, but you don't have a relationship with God. Michael, how the hell do you know? Worm, how the hell do you know? That's better. Stranger, because up until today, you've been killing yourself with alcohol. That's how I know. Michael, fine. How do you have a relationship with God? Stranger, you see the literature table over there? Right in the middle, there's a blue book. The answer to your questions is in there. And he walked away. And I never saw that guy again, but he was right. What I needed was in the book. It wasn't in the meetings or in the phone calls or the stories. That's the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. No real alcoholic recovers in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The fellowship was designed as the support system for the program. The program is the first 164 pages of our basic text. We don't change in the fellowship. We go to the fellowship to receive love and support while we change through the program. And two things that every newcomer should know about this program of ours. One, it's almost comically simple. Two, it's meant to be done rapidly. So that's Michael's story. And I found the two to be critical. I personally did not do this quickly. When I came in, I was beaten into a state of reasonableness. Bill W. talks about that. Let me give you the guest call in number if there's a brave soul out there. It's 949-534-0621. I came in and I was beaten into a state of reasonableness, finally, after about bad divorce had come down. I tried to make it before that, but I was trying to save a marriage, and I really wasn't that interested. When the divorce came down and it was a really bad divorce, I was beaten into that state of reasonableness, and it was a really hard divorce. I lost 12 years of savings, a business, a home, a wife. I was looking at jail time and the insane asylum, all in a fortnight. The world had moved out from under my feet. I'm a pretty tough guy, and it would take something very drastic to move me, and it did. When I found the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I cried because I was in so much pain, people were glad that I was there and I was serious. It was in the Aquarius group in Dallas. And soon I asked, is there a, I was told to get a sponsor. Sponsor someone who gives their experience, strength, and hope and takes you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was one fellow I had started going earlier on and really wasn't serious, didn't have that pain to drive me. I asked for this fellow, Bob. And I said, where's Bob? He was always very kind to me. He was a dentist. And he had lost his professional license because of drugs and alcohol. Now, this is 15 years ago, so they're a little bit more lenient today as compared to the way they were back then. And I said, where's Bob? He said, well, Bob's not with us anymore. I said, well, I thought maybe just moved. He had a window cleaning business, and that's got to be very humiliating or humbling for sure to a doctor, a professional man, cleaning windows. Bob tried to get back into his profession as a assistant or in a lower capacity, and they wouldn't even let him do that. Evidently, he had put a lot of thought and energy and hope into that, and when that was crashed, instead of putting another ounce of alcohol into his body, he went to Bachman Lake in Dallas and blew his brains out. Bob was gone. Everybody was sad to see him go. We would rather have him take a drink than to kill himself, for sure. Because where there's life, there's hope. Suicide haunts the rooms of AA. I tell my sponsees that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. It's also the sincerest form of self-criticism. And it's also considered a slip. A slip. Slip is a term we use to say someone had gone out for a short period of time to drink. And then hurried back in. A slip is sort of like a loss of balance quickly recovered. And I was given a Rum Radio recovery cards at a club, Post Oak, and it's about a year or so ago. And this fella, I was given a card to, and he said, oh, you had given me a card about a year ago. And I gave it to my sponsor, he really liked it, and it's all over Dallas. I said, that's great. He says, you know that part about suicide? And yeah, I went over the tenants, and that he says, you know that part where you said it's also considered a slip? I said, yeah. He says, when I read that, I decided not to kill myself. He could have knocked me over with a feather. I would have never expected something, it's almost tongue-in-cheek, but to an alcoholic who's been in the program for some time, taking another drink of alcohol is such a betrayal of the program and of himself that he would rather go out and kill himself. So when he heard that it's just like doing a drink anyway, he decided not to kill himself. And I understood that when he told me. I was surprised that God put this man in my life and told me this. And to me, it was just a reaffirmation or an affirmation. What I was doing with Rum Radio was the correct thing to do. That it helped this man. So if nothing else comes from the work with Rum Radio, it saved that man's life. Yay! So that's a good thing, no doubt. So I went to, soon after, Dallas was too small for me and the ex-to-be Mrs. And she insisted I go to Austin. I had business interest in Austin and had to start my business from scratch. I remember going in I had a 78 Volkswagen van with my remnants of I had a neon art sculpture business, and parts of that business came with me, filled in the van. I'm going to Austin from Dallas in an ice storm. And on the way into Austin, I chanted all the way, God loves me and wants to see me happy. God loves me and wants to see me happy. And got through that storm. Started my business up. As soon as I got there, first thing I did, I called Intergroup. And Intergroup, it's always a great resource. If you're out of town and you're looking for a meeting, which I recommend, I look forward. When I travel, no far or wide, I call up Intergroup, and even before I go, try to map out where the closest meetings are, their times and locations. It's really a lot of fun to go to meetings all over the world or all over the country. The common thread, the familiarity of being home in a remote, a place where you've never been before, with like type. I like to think that my fellow alcoholics in recovery are less than kin, but more than kind. We're like survivors from a great shipwreck. We have a camaraderie and an empathy rarely found amongst most. The only other place where I found that kind of camaraderie are usually around combat veterans. But very rarely do we get together or combat veterans get together. They do maybe initially, but as they move away into their life, that doesn't happen. But in AA, we're thrown together in a way very few people are. So I call up in a group, and I got to Austin and found that there was the Hope Group. And the Hope Group was I wasn't familiar with my way around, so I called to find out where the Hope Group was located. And I was getting directions, go up the street. He says, you make here, and it's a dead-end road. And you go down the road, and it's the last house on the block. It's a little yellow house, and it looks like a place where alcoholics would go. It was an interesting turn of phrase. When I say that in a meeting, I usually get a chuckle. So we did that. I went into the meeting and find my sponsor. And it was the least likely of men. We're told, especially back then, and they still do. I don't particularly agree with that, but you're supposed to find somebody who has something that you want. Of course, I really didn't know what I wanted. I know I was in a lot of pain, and I knew I had to work recovery. But Kenneth was was wearing a jumpsuit, was slovenly, looked like he just got off the street, but he was sharing, and it was a very spiritual share, and I noticed that's what I wanted. I wanted his spirituality. I liked the way he shared. I liked that spirituality. So I asked him after the meeting if he would be my sponsor. He agreed, and he told me basically to read the first 164 pages of the big book, take two aspirins, and call him in the morning. And as soon as I had read that, we would go over the rest of the work, which was fine. I mean, so we started that. He read to me. We did the first three steps. And it took a little time, and I was feeling pretty cocky and confident now. My business started taking off, and I found a new home, and things were starting to click for me, and I was making money and trying to regain the position that I had before, and I liked the area. Austin's a real nice town, and all of a sudden it got to do, well, how about doing the fourth step? And I says, well, I'm staying sober. Is that not enough? And what I found, and it happens to a lot of folks early on in recovery, is that we come into the meetings and we plop our butts down. And I like to think I was going to get this program. See, once the pain is gone, see, the pain got me into the rooms. The pain got me started. But once my life started, all the things from drinking and drugging were disappearing. Those consequences were diminishing. And when that happens, and I'm being accepted into a new group, and I got a girlfriend, and my business is working well, I'm getting a life again, and all of that, the pain's gone. Well, with the pain, so's the motivation. And my sponsor would go, Kenneth would go, when are you going to work a fourth step? well, you know, I'm staying sober. Is that not enough? I was going to get this program, and I tried it for years through the process of osmosis. Osmosis is the process by which if you go to enough AA meetings, it comes up, all that you hear in the meetings comes up through the floor, up the chair, up your ass, into your head. And you feel, well, I know how this works now. So I don't have to do the hard work of step 4 and 5 and the amends on 9 and all that. I got it. I'm not going to drink. I'm good. And that kept me for years. I've learned a lot in spite of myself, but until life on life's terms got to me. Until I was again beaten into a state of reasonableness. That means I'm teachable. I like to think humility. Humility is like underwear. Essential, unless it shows, then it becomes indecent. So I'm again beaten into a state of reasonableness, and it came with the death of my oldest daughter, Julianne. Accidental morphine overdose in New Jersey. I was sober about 5 years. And I went to New Jersey, and that was a tough time for me. I was trying to get Julie into the rooms. She had tried to move in with me, and she was smoking crack and not ice, I think they called it. It was methamphetamine. And I couldn't put up with that, and I wasn't going to live with an addict. And I had to do some tough love to get her to leave. But I invited her back. She said she wanted to move in with me later on. I said, if you work the first 5 steps, you could come in. But you have to work the first 5 steps. And to sweeten the pot, I'll give you $500, $100 a step. And then you can move in with me. I'll give you $500. And I was asking her, Julie, have you worked the steps yet? Julie, have you worked the steps? And finally, she says, yeah, I have. I says, great, give me your sponsor's phone number. And I called her sponsor. And I says, hi, this is Joseph and Julie's dad. And Julie said she worked the first 5 steps. And she says, I'm sorry, Joseph. She said, Julie had offered me $100 to lie to you and tell you that she had worked her steps. Okay, so Julie didn't do that. And Julie was doing good. She was going to go back to school. She got a scholarship. She, as far as I know, she was staying straight. And I got a call one night that she had overdosed. I believe it was a situation where things were going really good in her life. And she decided, and sometimes that is just as dangerous for a drug addict and an alcoholic as when things are going bad. Sometimes, and she had taken so much morphine that she exasperated in her sleep and couldn't roll over and drowned in her vomit. And I walked in, when I went to New Jersey, I walked in and there was a mistake with the family. They were out in the parking lot smoking, and they said the viewing was open to the family, and I walked in. I was the only one in there, and I hadn't seen my daughter in several years. And the scriptures say the pain was exquisite. And I didn't know what that meant until I experienced that. And once I experienced the pain, exquisite pain, it was like my spirit left my body. And I was there, though, for my other children. I was the rock there, even though I hadn't only worked my first 3 steps, but I had been going to AA and living a sober lifestyle. It was a plateau of recovery, and that I was able to not worry about myself, grieve later, but to be there for my other daughters, which was a bonding for my family. We had been separated for a while. And everything went well. My daughters came to Houston, and several years after that, my youngest daughter, Christina, was also a drug addict and an alcoholic. She got involved with someone at one of the meetings, and it was they got married, had a child, got divorced, and she couldn't handle it. She stopped the work of recovery. When two people get together and they fall in love, no sense doing the hard work of recovery. We're in love and it's two against the world. And it produced my grandchild, Claire. And I got the phone call from the same former son-in-law that I had gotten 8 or 9 years earlier. Christina had died of an accidental overdose of cocaine, methamphetamine, and ethyl alcohol. She was 23. So these are the things that got me back into action, working the steps and being of maximum service to God and my fellows. That service work is the rumradio.org website. We do the website, so their stories are on there, my story's on there to some degree, and then a lot of sponsorship. And I believe sponsorship is the key to this thing. There's a feeling going around now in the rooms that we're going back to a basics, back to basics. And we're just reading that that is a sponsorship convention, or that's in Dallas, and their main thrust is going to be sponsorship. There's a Big Book sponsorship website. There's a Big Book sponsorship Facebook. And their strength, their thrust is like my thrust, is to work the steps immediately, not to wait. I don't actually believe in the dating aspect of sponsorship where you've got to find somebody that works with you and you go to plenty of meetings. And I think that's a waste of time. I think pain is a resource and we should use it as fuel. When a person comes in, I try to get them right away. I hold hands as we go around hold hands and have the Lord's Prayer. Some clubs do that. And I go around to the newcomer when I'm looking for a sponsee. And so I'm holding his hand. I got him by the hand already. And then I ask him, have you had enough? Yes or no? Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? If I get two affirmatives, I tell them you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. I whip out Clancy's 7 questions. It's on the site. I hand it to him and said, I need these questions answered. I need them back tomorrow. Here's my phone number. I expect your call. If I get the phone call the next day and he's done the work, we're off to the races and I give him the assignments and all that. I've been successful in this approach. The person is hot. He's in a lot of pain and he's willing to get out of the pain. He's willing to agree to anything at that point just because what we sell in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is hope. And so that's the hope that we give to the newcomer. And I think starting with that pain, and that pain is that fuel to get him through. And what I've discovered, I had an epiphany about step 6 recently, is that if I lose a sponsee in the work, it's usually right after 5 and before 6. And if you look at step 6, there's not much to step 6. But what I find out is after step 5, it's the beginning of true kinship between God and man. After 5, most of the pain, if not all the pain, is gone. And when the pain is gone, the motivation is gone, and that's my personal experience. So I get them through. Once I do 5, I want to do 6 and 7 within the day. No more. I make the schedule immediately to get them through to 6 and 7. Usually, once I get them to 7, they're more than halfway through. And now they're more than likely to do it because they're more than halfway through. So it's the human condition. I'm more than halfway through. So it's easier to go forward than to go back. We've crossed the halfway point. But that's my experience. So next week, or what we're going to be doing, Monday is going to be rewind. We're going to be rewinding this on Monday. So this way you can hear this the second time. It's also on the archives. Saturday night, next week, is going to be, we're going to follow up on this series. It's called An Overview of Quick Drying Glue. So we know who Michael is. He wrote these posts. And next week is going to be the overview. He's going to tell you what he's going to tell you. And then we'll start with step one the week after that. And we're going to take somebody through the 12 steps of alcoholics in 24 hours. So this is Joseph G. reminding you, see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.